And so, maybe quite appropriately, the theme is equanimity. And equanimity is sometimes considered to be the crown jewel of Buddhism, Buddhist practice. And it's a little hard. It certainly was hard for me when I was a new student to have any relationship to this concept of equanimity, let alone to appreciate how it could be treated as a crown jewel, like the most valuable treasure that Buddhism has. But there is no Buddhism except for what we find in ourselves. So how could this be one of the most valuable treasures that we possess, this equanimity thing? I couldn't have understood that. And that was something that slowly dawned on me as I practiced and grew, and it's still developing and growing. It's maybe never ending to appreciate this, but it's not just being, it's not being aloof. It's not being indifferent. It's not being cold and unfeeling. It's actually in some ways the opposite of all those things. It's being very connected and very present. It's being very caring to what's going on, and it's being very what was the third one I said? Aloof, indifferent, and cold. It's warm. And because it's such an important quality, perhaps, or you know, that in Buddhist practice it's so valued. You know, there's certain areas in life where people who specialize in that area, they have an extensive vocabulary to describe all the nuances of differences, and like people who are study the ocean have all these different names for waves. You know, I just know there's waves. Look, it's a wave. But you know, all these different names for different kinds of waves, and so these Buddhists use the word equanimity. They have some different names that are equivalent, but kind of different. But they recognize all these different kinds of equanimity, and there's, you know, it goes on and on, the different types, and it's such a rich and multifaceted phenomenon. One of the forms of equanimity is equanimity as a faculty for feeling, a feeling faculty. The same faculty that you can feel, where you not feeling in terms of emotions, but of vedana, the sensations. That ability we have, the senses we have to pick up whether something is painful or pleasant, those are called faculties, faculties for pleasant, faculty for unpleasant. In the same way, there's a particular faculty, like maybe there's nerve endings. I don't know where, you know, I don't know what these Buddhists, ancient Buddhists, were thinking, but they said it was a particular faculty that's able to feel equanimity. And so it's a feeling that, and that just like a pleasant and unpleasant, you can feel throughout the body, you know, different places. So this equanimity thing somehow can be also be an embodied experience. A deep stability, a deep stillness, a deep idea of being unperturbed, unruffled, with all the different things that can occur. And wonderfully, and luckily, the faculty of equanimity that can sense and feel equanimity can operate together with the faculty that feels pleasant and painful. Meaning that it's possible to experience, that's one of the functions of equanimity, is to have the capacity to feel things which are deep, very uncomfortable, painful, things that are very pleasant, and stay balanced and stay unreactive to it, not leaning towards it, leaning away from it. The pleasant experiences that we have, there's often a tendency to lean towards it and want it, to want more of it. The unpleasant thing is often a tendency to lean away and push it away and want to reject it. And that movement of for and against, leaning one direction or the other, wanting or pushing away are all forms of agitation of the mind, agitation of the system, that that represents non-equanimity. So equanimity, the faculty of equanimity, has the ability, or when we have it, when it's strong, we feel it, then we can feel something that's painful, and it's kind of like there's a room for it, or space for it, or it's just kind of held in a nice, I don't know, soup. And same thing if something's pleasant. It's just held in space for it and room for it. And we don't have to, and we don't succumb to that natural enough human tendency to be for and against, to want that and not want that. But we can just experience things. I really like this. I want to say that again. We can experience things and just let it be an experience. We don't have to do anything with it. We don't have to make meaning to it. We don't have to have a preference with it. We don't have to be for or against it. And I'm talking about this at the rudimentary level of just sense experience. As things come in through the eyes, the initial sensations coming in, sounds coming to the ears, that initial, just the sound themselves, the smells, the tastes, the tactile experience, just them, just the immediacy of that. And it also the immediacy of certain kind of mental phenomena when they first arise. The beginning of a thought, just a thought, as opposed to what the thought means and the big picture that they're part of. That's important too. But that initial, just the initial contact with experience, kind of like the nerve contact, to allow that experience just to be itself. Keep it so simple. It's not easy to do. But it's nice to know that this is kind of the North Star, or the direction we're going. By having this equanimity faculty become stronger. So we're not supposed to just kind of like now hold ourselves still, you know, and pretend to be unmoving and, you know, unshaking. That doesn't work. Diana talked so nice yesterday about the soft mind, malleable mind. It's not just a soft mind that we cultivate and practice. It's a soft body. And the body gets softer, and so that, or the feeling of it at least. And so that when the sense contact comes, it just it's not met by brittleness. It's not met by reactivity. It's not met by reactivity. It's just there. Experience allows us to be for what it is. And so I remember, I'll tell you the story, when I was practicing in Zen, the way we meditated was we would sit facing the wall. So we sat on platforms, kind of like this size here. So you can imagine that was a person sitting like in these kinds of mats, and it would turn around. I'd be turned around facing the wall, and so sometimes the teachers would walk. And we're all in rows, you know, proper rows, and so all around the periphery, kind of, and so the teacher would walk around, and in Zen they often like to adjust posture. And so they'd come up and they'd gently put their hand on your shoulder to let you know they're there. And then once you knew you were there, they would somehow kind of do a little adjustment to your back. It's usually pretty gentle, or, you know, sometimes I was a Leaning Tower of Gill, and they would come and just go like that to me. You know, they put the hand on the shoulder and they go, so it usually wasn't a big deal what they did, but they did a little. So what was interesting to me was that if I was, which I did, you know, every once in a blue moon or something, maybe, some, you know, daydreaming. It was known to almost happen. And I started daydreaming, thinking a lot, and they'd put their hand on my shoulder, I would startle. But if I wasn't involved in daydreaming and thinking, if I was just really, I was relatively calm, but present, and not thinking about something else, they would come and touch my shoulder, and my body would feel like jello. And I would just, it was unexpected, but I would just, I would receive it, and it was like jello or something. And so this idea of not being brittle or being so caught has a lot to do with how much mental activity we have. And at least it is for me, or somehow being caught in my thoughts, or the world of thinking for me was often where I get triggered by all kinds of things. And so the ability to not be in that triggering world was fascinating to see that difference. And to learn to let experience just be experience. There's times for making meaning. There's times for being for and against things. There's times for, there's times for just about everything, the context. And I say that because as I was thinking about giving this talk about equanimity, one of the dangers, there are a number of dangers of listening to a Buddhist teacher. We should have disclaimers or banners and say caution, and this talk may be dangerous for. And one of them is, one of the dangers, when the banners would say caution, this talk comes with a danger of thinking it applies to all of life. And that, so if we're talking about equanimity, it's like, I'll do my best to talk about equanimity, and I can be, really into it, and like, this is the most important thing. And then people leave saying, now I'm supposed to be equanimous all the time. This is like the way you're supposed to live, the way you're supposed to be, and this is it, Don't do that. Equanimity is contextual. There's a time and place for profound equanimity or use or equanimity to be equanimous. And even the Buddha talked about, sometimes in the suttas, he chastises his monks sometimes for when, he said when, there was some monk, I think, was being criticized, wrongly, I think. And so the Buddha criticized the other monks and said, that was not a time to be equanimous. You should have come to your friend, your fellow monk's defense, or spoken up. And so he clearly said, that was not the time to be equanimous. It's equanimous and let everything just be, and So I don't want to get the impression here today that, equanimity is like the be-all and end-all, and you're supposed to now go be that way forever. But I do want to give the message that equanimity is something to value. It's a treasure, it's something to care for, it's something to be, to consider, and something to learn about how it works and how it functions and when it's there, how to be with it and how to support it to be there. And just kind of become fluent in the language or the phenomenon of equanimity. So there is this equanimity as a feeling, which is kind of fascinating, a faculty of a feeling you can have. And then there's also equanimity, which is of the mind. That the mind can be, and they use this wonderful term in Buddhist English, imperturbable. And it's translating a Pali word of being unagitated, unruffled, not restless, unwrestled mind. Unrestless mind. So some people don't like the idea of equanimity because it just seems kind of dull. But the idea of not being agitated, hopefully, is a welcome idea, or not being restless is a welcome idea. And then that's what we're talking about, a mind which doesn't get agitated by, so things can happen. We can have thoughts, things can happen in the world. And there might be things we have to take care of and address, but the mind doesn't get agitated. And to have thoughts of how to live our life and impulses of how to act come not from intuition, which is kind of vague what it's about, but come from clarity and understanding. But out of a mind that is not agitated, that's not straining or pushing or wanting or not wanting, but it's almost like it arises out of the emptiness, or arises out of space. It arises out of non-agitation. And some people think you have to get agitated in order to take care of things, to know what to do. But maybe we take care of things better if we're not agitated. So anyway, so there's two forms of agitation, that of the body, the senses, how we feel and take in these experiences, and then there's the equanimity of the mind. And then there's lots of other lists of equanimities. In the teachings on the seven factors of awakening, the last factor of awakening is equanimity, and the word is upekkha. And this is a word that has a prefix, upa, and then a main part of the word, I don't remember exactly how to properly say what the word is, but it doesn't matter. But the main part of the word means to look upon, or to look. And upa means upon, or from above, or down to, or something. And so upekkha has the literal etymological meaning to look upon something. I love the idea of a kind of a little bit of a bird's eye view. It's kind of a mature place where we're able to see what's there. We kind of step back. We're not in the fray, but we can step back and see what's there. I still have the very almost visceral memory of a time when I was when I was about 20 or so, 19. And I was in college, and I was living in a little apartment with four other college students. And we had a little living room with a little balcony with sliding glass doors. And for some reason, I was out in the balcony with the sliding doors closed, and my two friends were talking in an animated way on the couch. But because the sliding door was closed, I couldn't hear what they were saying. And somehow standing there and watching them being animated and not being part of any idea what they were talking about, and just watching, and I just felt so peaceful. Like I felt like, wow. Mm-hmm. It's just like just to be here and watch and not be caught in the fray or involved. I mean, everything they were having, it wasn't an argument, so it wasn't like a bad thing, but it was just like, oh, so to step back, like you're in a crowd of people who are arguing, and then you have to go to the bathroom. When you come back, you stand in the door and look in. It's wow. Look at all those people. They're yelling and screaming, and you stand there like, wow, that's really interesting. I don't know if I want to go in there. I'll just stand here and watch. And so you're not caught in it. There's some kind of stepping back and not being caught and excited and, you know, so this idea of having an overview of the situation and the balance of mind, mind that can come from that overview is a little bit what's meant by this word upekkha. And so there's in the teachings on the seven factors of awakenings, it talks about in order to support it, to nourish it, we have to give careful attention to something. So all of these factors of awakening, it's a careful attention to something that allows them to arise. And the teachings that the Buddha gave about what we give careful attention to, and this for equanimity, is not that helpful. Because he says, pay attention, careful attention to that which is the basis for equanimity. Period. the basis? Well, then you're like, where's the rest of it? You know, what's the basis? But I love it. I actually love the fact that he doesn't go on to explain what that is, because that means there are many bases, many conditions for the arising of equanimity, not just one. And each of us probably have different conditions that supports us and helps us to be equanimous. It's a personal thing. And this goes along with one of the things that I like to emphasize, is that the Dharma practice is very personal. And so like another one of those caution banners that the state of California prints for Dharma teachers. Caution. This Dharma talk might not be relevant for you. Because, you know, we're all, in some ways, we're very different from each other. And so what's suited for one person is not suited for another person. And so it takes a lot of, you know, the real Dharma book that we need to study is our own book in our hearts and our minds. And how do we respond to things? And how do we, what's best for us? And what supports us to be free? And what supports us to develop and grow each of the seven factors of awakening? And so no one can tell you that. Dharma teachers can just give, you know, throw out ideas and hope that some of them are relevant. And so, you know, the idea that Buddha doesn't specify what the condition is that to focus on for equanimity puts the responsibility back to us. You know, it's kind of nice. You know, study yourself, find out what supports you. So there are many things that could support equanimity. The Buddhist tradition puts a lot of emphasis on virtue, and I think when we live an ethical life, then we're not less likely to be agitated by our ethics, and so that leads to a certain kind of equanimity. The Buddha said that you can then walk into any assembly and be relaxed, or not feel worried about that. So. There's the equanimity of having a lot of confidence and trust in the Dharma and the practice and yourself. Sometimes it's reconnecting to what we really have faith in or trust in, or where our confidence lies, and to call upon that in situations that normally would agitate us, so that the confidence carries the day, and so we're less likely to get, you know, discombobulated because we have confidence. In so many places in life, when people get upset and angry, I suspect that one of the conditions for being upset is a lack of confidence in one's own efficacy, one's own ability to somehow address situation or take care of oneself in the situation. And then sometimes that upsetness, then we spill out and, you know, think that something out there needs to be done. But to cultivate confidence and trust and faith is one of the big important tasks of Dharma practice. And that doesn't come easily. It's something sometimes takes a while to develop, sometimes a long time to develop. And for some people, Dharma practitioners, I've known people for the first 5 or 10 years of Dharma practice, the thing that was really maturing from developing and what needed to do was the faculty of faith and confidence and trust. And it was beautiful to watch that grow and how that kind of everyday, kind of so much changed and shift and freed up just with that faculty. So to call upon confidence and trust and that's one of the beautiful things that a number of people I've talked to and in myself comes with mindfulness practice, is that someday to be able to say that to have a deep abiding trust when we are in mindfulness, that if I can be really mindful of things, things will work out. I don't know how, but when I'm mindful, somehow the system, the mind, the heart, the circumstances begins to shift, and it seems to work out well. If in no other way, it works out well because we don't get caught in our inner reactivity. And so it works out well because, in the sense that we don't harm ourselves. And there are circumstances in life where, you know, that's maybe the only thing that's relevant. Sooner or later, there's rumors that some of you will be dying. You know, I don't want to assume. And so some of you will get a diagnosis that's going to be terminal. And you'll do what you can do to try to stay alive and take care of that. But some of you, it's not going to work. And that'll be the thing that will come bring you to your end sooner or later. And so mindfulness. Everything's going to work out well because I'm mindful. It's not going to protect you from that last, you know, passing away, but everything will work out spiritually. Everything will work out emotionally. It's phenomenal what mindfulness can do when it can hold the experience and make room. And if we have confidence in that, then it's a lot easier to be equanimous and balanced. I have this practice, and I have confidence in the practice. And then there's the equanimity that comes from doing the practice, not just having the practice, but doing it. Doing the practice that cultivates greater clarity, so we can see what's going on. We do a practice that cultivates greater calm and settledness and stability. And that ability to see what's going on gives us the information so we can see our reactivity as it begins. We can see some of the underlying conditions. And we don't have to kind of pick it up or get involved, and we can just stay more balanced through things. We develop concentration, calm, and the calm has more room. The calm, you know, we're less likely to be triggered reactively suddenly because somehow, like the example of them touching my shoulder in the Zen meditation halls, you know, I was calm, and so there was lots of room for things. And I think most of you probably have some experience of how a calm state allows you to be much more at ease in situations that you're not at ease in when you're tense. So to cultivate practices, to do practices that puts us into nice states, useful states, and there's equanimity that comes from that. There's equanimity that comes from having wisdom to understand how things work a little bit and have street smarts and understand that if you do X, Y follows, or to have the wisdom, the understanding, you know, I don't have to take it so personally. Someone says something to you and maybe it's extremely unkind. Maybe they, you know, they tell you that go away. But, you know, it's a three-year-old. You know, and it's your three-year-old. And, you know, just 5 minutes earlier, they asked you if you'd marry them. And now they're like, they're looking at you like you're like the worst person in the world. You know, you can't take these kids so personally. And then there's people who get old and some people who are dying. I mean, one of the phenomena sometimes of people who are dying in slow death, which kind of the chemicals begin doing something, is sometimes they take it out in the people who are closest to them. And the hospice nurses or hospice physicians will know to tell family, you know, to let them know this is coming, this might be coming, or if that happens, you know, this is a phenomenon, it's well known, and it probably just has to do with chemicals. You don't take it personally. And I've known family members who were told this and it happened and so they didn't have to kind of take the usual meaning that they had from their lifetime, how they would do it otherwise. So, 3-year-olds, 99-year-olds, and then what about everybody in between? Is it appropriate not to take things personally? What does it mean to take something personally? Have you ever considered that? What are you actually doing when you take something personally? The kind of the Buddhist analogy for taking things personally, maybe it's not a good fit for all the meanings of taking it personally, but the Buddhist analogy is holding up a flag so it can be shot. So look at, you know, over here, look. And so then, you know, they bow an arrow, they something like that. So that's a rather violent image. So I just like it, I do this, you know, taking it personally is like putting up your hand like this. And so that when the words people say or the things people do have something to hit inside of us. Something inside of us is up and, you know, ready to read, you know, and that hurts. But to not take it personally, it's kind of like this. Nothing there, just goes right through. So what is it that's active? What is it that we're holding up? What are we holding on to? What are we projecting? What are we requiring when we take things personally? And so, you know, if the state of California comes and says, you know, all these banners and caution signs have to be on the wall every time I give a Dharma talk, I might take it very personally. You know, I'm a perfectly good and competent Dharma teacher, and doesn't California know that? And, you know, and I get all huffed up and agitated, and I'm caught up in being a good, clear, you know, proper Dharma teacher, and so that, boy, the state of California just like ran right into me, and it took me years to recover from that one, you know. But eventually I kind of learned that you don't have to have this identity of being the, you know, a good Dharma teacher. It's fine to be a mediocre Dharma teacher, and, you know, or even a lousy one, as long as people are helped and a little bit, and, you know, it's fine. And so I kind of like, you know, if I put that all down, you know, I don't even have to be a Dharma teacher to give talks, you know, I just talk. And as long as I get away with it, it's I'll keep doing it. And so I'm holding a Dharma teacher thing. And so those banners come, and I just thought, oh, that's interesting. They could have used nicer fonts, you know, or something, you know, just like, you know, it doesn't hit anything. So when you take something personal, what's actually happening? And do you sometimes hold something up and, you know, that something can be hit? And what in the world is Gil talking about when he talks about not having anything in there that is hit, that just goes right through? What does that mean? I mean, is that bizarre? And so anyway, some of this equanimity comes from the wisdom of not taking certain things personally. And I'm sure that all of you are old enough to have a lot of wisdom around what not to take personally. If I was a betting person, I bet I would bet on it. All you have to do is probably compare yourself to when you were 15. I know for me, when I was 15 or 14, I mean, the things that I took personally, that I don't take personally now, it's like, you know, it's, I'm really wise compared to then. You know, so, I mean, you know, one of the major things when I was 13 or 14 that was really important and serious, that, you know, was a big concern and had to have a lot of thought and care repeatedly and attention and solutions and learning ways to escape and get out of danger, and all. It had to do with zits. Those zits, you know, but if I get a zit now, I hardly even notice myself, let alone care what you guys think about my zit. I don't take these zits so personally. And if you do have an opinion about me, you know, with a zit, I couldn't care less. I don't take it personally if you say, you know, a Dharma teacher shouldn't have zits. How could, it's just like, okay. But taking it personally is a very personal thing. So I don't want to just make fun of it and kind of make these silly examples. We have a lot of care, compassion for this thing because it's personal. You know, we say it's personal. You know, that what I'm feeling now or what the impact. When someone says that it's personal, I kind of get soft and I slow down and pay attention and have a lot of respect and care, just that. So even though we take it personally, is maybe we can see it's kind of an unnecessary identification with something, but it often has its roots, its basis in something that's very tender and vulnerable or caring or valuable or precious that's somehow operating. And so another source of equanimity is a lot of compassion, lots of care, lots of love. And so to cultivate compassion or to remember compassion and the compassion for others and compassion for ourselves, maybe it's easier for the mind not to get agitated and ruffled, and we can stay calmer and more peaceful and then respond accordingly or appropriately. There's equanimity that comes from not clinging to things, not holding on to things. And so as the practice deepens and we learn to recognize how we cling and hold on, to let go. There's equanimity that comes from developing strength, inner strength. And some of strength comes from healing. So some things need to be healed. And only when they're healed can we have equanimity. And so how do we use the mindfulness and compassion and, you know, what is it that to recognize what needs healing and to care for that and tend that so that someday that also can be a support for the equanimity. It's a basis for equanimity. In the seven factors of awakening, each of these seven factors is one of the condition for the next. So when the Buddha says, pay attention to the basis for equanimity, give careful attention to the basis of equanimity, the clearest basis in that teaching is concentration. Because out of concentration, concentration is a support for the arising of equanimity. And as I've said before, in these factors of awakening, these are not things we're supposed to do, but things that we somehow cultivate and allow them to grow. And this is important because otherwise it's too easy to hear a talk on equanimity and think, I'm supposed to be equanimous. I'm supposed to kind of do this thing now and be this way. And to try too hard to be equanimous, it's a surefire way to be non-equanimous or to become brittle. So to cultivate the conditions for the soft mind and open mind and relaxed mind and spacious mind that can hold things is part of the function of concentration practice. And when the Buddha talked about the conditions that support the nourishments for the arising of concentration, he said you pay attention to careful attention to the experience of serenity that comes with concentration. There's something about the tranquility, serenity, peacefulness that comes with concentration that is support for more concentration. So it's kind of the... But the other one is non-dispersal. Give careful attention to non-dispersal. I'm not sure what the original Pali is or what the Buddha meant, but I love this idea, at least how I interpret it. That non-dispersal means this fragmentation, that we're kind of like off in orbit and we're scattered and rather than being whole or held, everything's held together. You know, body and mind are working together in harmony. So this feeling of being unified, non-dispersed, feeling of serenity is support for concentration. But these feelings of serenity, of non-dispersal, of concentration, give us a reference point for a way of being that is supportive for equanimity. As we have deeper feelings of ease, of calm, of peace, of sense of well-being, just like Diana said, that I like the word well-being because it's so vague. So we can kind of maybe it's vague enough that we can find what it means for ourselves, you know, the different flavors of what it might be like. But the idea of as concentration has, you know, develops, however small it might be, the concentration, it gives us a reference point for what's possible, and it allows us to highlight choices we have. And, you know, we don't always have choices, but, you know, it's like, you know, you've been doing now this practice for 5-6 days here. I'm sure you're all calmer than you realize. So that's clear. So it's clear to me, but it's not to you, right? That's what, by definition, what I'm saying, you're calmer than you realize, that you don't know it. And more settled, but you probably recognize, maybe some of you recognize you are calmer than you were before, you first day or something, more settled and all that. And I say to you, you know, this has been a great retreat, but I think that, you know, it's, we should probably take a little break from it, and we'll go down to the boardwalk, do some of the rides, and there's a bowling alley right nearby. We'll spend some time bowling, and then we'll go down to the pizza joint where it's kind of crowded, but it's okay, it's good pizza, and then we'll come back and continue our meditation. So if I offer you that as an option, I'm sorry, some of you might take over. But you know, you might have the wisdom that to say, well, you know, another time. But after 5 days of sitting and I've gotten to this calm, I think that probably I'm better off staying here and staying close to that. And so you choose to stay close. So you know something. You have a reference point for something. Oh, this is good. This is worth maintaining or staying close to, or not giving up so easily just for, you know, amusement park. And so there's a whole series of reference points about, oh, not this. I don't need to do this. Some of it might have to do with certain thoughts that arise. You've been reviewing now for 40 years or 50 years this thing that happened in high school, and what he said, what she said, what they said, you know, all these, you know. And, you know, this is like the best guess. It's like the 52,000th time in the last 10 years you've thought about this little incident. And you're calm and peaceful, and you see those thoughts arise, and you have your little counter, 52,001, and you say, wait a minute. Maybe I don't need to get involved. Maybe just leave that one alone. You couldn't control it. You couldn't control whether the thought arose, but getting involved, no, I don't need to do that anymore. as the subtleness, as we get more settled and clear and the mindfulness becomes clear, it's not just things that we've seen 52,000 times coming up, but after a while it becomes things that have arisen just two or three times. To some point, it might even be something that's arising for the first time. And we see, and you don't have to, it doesn't even have to matter what the content of the thoughts are. We have a reference point for a sense of stability and peace and well-being and spacious attention for things that feels good. And so the equanimity comes from something arises and it just feels so good not to get involved in that thought, no matter what it is. And sometimes in deep concentration, it doesn't matter what the thought is. Not getting involved just feels so much better. And so there's an equanimity towards thoughts. We're not so interested in them. We're not invested in them. And they can come, they can go, but we're not oriented towards them. We're not invested in them. We're not thinking that every thought is significant, that every thought is important every time it arises, that every thought is as authority. The amount of authority we invest in our thoughts sometimes is phenomenal. And nowhere have I read or learned or been told by anyone that I was supposed to give authority to every thought I have. Like it's like true, like it's important, like I have to listen to it. But there was a period in my life where I did that. I assumed that if I thought it, it must be true and important and, you know, and has to be listened to or something. And now a thought arises, and if it seems, if the wisdom in my mind says that's important, I better think that some more, then I will. But there's plenty of times either it's not important or it's not the time when I want to think about it. So I'll just let it be. But there's something better going on than to get involved in that thought. And so there's a certain equanimity then about thinking. You know, thoughts come and go, and all kinds of thoughts. I don't have to take them personally. I don't have to believe them. I don't have to be pushed around by them. And so thoughts arise, they come and they go. And so I coined a new word that some of you have heard me say before. So there's thinking, and then there's thoughting. Thinking is when I put the thoughts together, association. One goes to the other. It's like I get involved, and there's, you know, it's like building this whole thing. And a lot of thinking is associated thinking. It just goes from one to the next. Thoughting, it's just what the mind does sometimes. It's a little thoughting machine. Pumps out a thought. But if I don't react, get involved, think about it, you know, then it doesn't go anywhere. It's just a thought, you know, like soap bubbles. You know, it's like soap bubbles of the mind. You know, and so the bubble comes and then it pops, comes and goes. So to see thoughts that way or close to that, or, you know, can produce more equanimity around thoughts. So to the degree to which at this point in the retreat, you have some subtleness, that you have some spaciousness, that you have some calm, that you have some clarity about what's happening, you're able to be in the present, to the degree to which you have compassion, care and love, to the degree to which you have some, some confidence, trust. Can you call upon that or bring caring, careful attention to that, hold it here, include it as part of here, so that as you continue being present for whatever is arising, that some parts of your mind, and maybe your heart, can remain unruffled. It doesn't get stirred up. It doesn't lean towards or pull away or doesn't get translated or transferred into compulsion to have or compulsion to push away. That your experience can just be your experience. Sounds maybe can just be sounds, especially if we can decrease the bells. And maybe sight objects can just be sight. Maybe body sensation can just be a body sensation. Pleasant can just be something pleasant. Unpleasant can just be something unpleasant. An emotion can just be an emotion. Anger can just be anger. Joy can just be joy. And thoughts that arise can just be a thought. And I offered the first day the word okay for equanimity. It's okay. Whatever it is, it's okay. It's okay. And, that word might not work for everyone. Another word that I've used for equanimity is whatever is happening, I add the word just in front of it. Just a thought. Just a feeling. Just a sound. And it's not the just that's dismissive or belittling of something. It's just saying, it's just, that's all it is. And all it is means it's allowed to be what it is without the addition of my assigning meaning or predicting where this is going to go, what's happening, thinking about the future, or taking it personally, or, whatever, all those complicated things we do. Just let it be. In fact, I think of this as being an equanimity itself, as something that's a way of offering profound respect to life. Maybe a kind of respect that's maybe, I don't know, emotionally I'm sitting here talking about it, thinking about it, feeling it. It's kind of like a respect that's deeper than deep. That's expand like respecting not just the planet as a whole, but respecting the cosmos, or respecting the nature we're part of, and deep respect for this process of life that we're in. That's deeper, more profound than my zits or some other things. It's a profound way in which whatever arises, whatever occurs, there's something about that being connected to the profundity of life. Whatever occurs somehow is important and respect-worthy. And so to have equanimity is not being aloof or indifferent. It's a way of allowing, giving, of loving, respecting everything to be itself. So whoever, all the individuals that we run into, to have equanimity means to profoundly respect them as they are, as they appear, as beautiful, respect-worthy elements of this natural world, this primordial world that we're here for part of. That whatever thought we have, no matter if it's a pleasant or an unpleasant thought, a kind thought or an unkind thought, to just let it be itself. We don't know what's working itself out. We don't know what it's all about. But to step back and give room and respect for something. Of course, ideally you don't act on the unkind thought. You don't speak it or something. But to see it and just like bow to it. And to, it's okay. Just a thought. Allowing each thing to be just itself. And guess who gets to be themselves? You. Profound equanimity allows you to be just as you are in the moment. And so here in this sitting posture and walking meditation, how can you have a settledness and equanimity, a calmness, a openness that can allow for a natural way of letting each thing let you just be itself, to respect it, to allow it? And that's the benefit that comes from this deep equanimity, this ability to offer this profound respect to each thing that occurs. And so I offer that, and I end with a talk with this, maybe as a little bit of a because that's one of the other banner that the state of California has, is caution. This teaching should be explored, should be discovered for yourself. It should be kind of, you know, don't believe it, but kind of search around and see, does anything in your correspond with it? So what is it? What in the world am I talking about here? An equanimity that allows for profound respect for whatever arises. Don't dismiss that too quickly, that idea. But what makes sense for you, and how do you explore that? And how can you kind of explore it gingerly, carefully, with a quiet mind, with a calm heart? Can you, because as the Buddha said, the equanimity as a factor of awakening arises out of concentration, arises out of a calm heart. So what do you have? What degree can you kind of explore this territory? And to what degree does that help you to do this profound respect of all things, including yourself? It supports you to get more peaceful, more present, and more here. And so that finally, the gesture that I have for equanimity. Remember, mindfulness is like this? The gesture, that, at least for me, that for equanimity is like this. So thank you all, and I offer this to each of you.